order the House Revenue Committee meeting this morning, and welcome everybody here today. We have set for a public hearing on House Bill 2187, and then work session just to introduce a couple of LCs that we have on the desk before us. Committee, if you haven't got your coffee this morning, be sure to get some. This is urban renewal today, and we will need it, I'm sure, except, of course, for Ms. Simpson, who's here to enliven up the meetings as she does every session on urban renewal. Welcome, Bandon, to be with us this morning. Mazin, why don't you give us the overview on House Bill 2187, then we'll go to John Phillips for the department's presentation.
Okay, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the House Bill 2187, in a small description of it, is trying to establish what the court ruling that I'll say a little more about has done in the Shiloh case. And just to give a quick background on this issue, since Measure 50 was implemented in 1997, the Urban Renewal Division of Taxes, which is primarily the mechanism by which urban renewal gets most of its financing, where a frozen value of property, what access above that frozen value becomes the Urban Renewal Division of Tax, as we know it. The Measure 5 limits of $5 per thousand for education and $10 per thousand for government still apply even with the Measure 50 and the division of tax. Now, the Supreme Court ruling with Shiloh N versus Multnomah County in December of 2001, what it had brought new into the discussion is that even when you have a division of tax of all the taxing districts in an urban renewal area, the end use of the tax would be the judge for how you categorize those taxes into the Measure 5 categories. In other words, if you're using those taxes for urban renewal, they should be categorized as government use rather than by the taxing district that established those taxes or levied the taxes. And in that, it has changed the definitions by which the prior to that ruling, the taxes were categorized. Previously, it was whoever levies the tax, then it becomes such. By doing that, precisely what the court seemed to have done is put or shifted the taxes after they're split into the use that is governed by the $10 per thousand for the government limit of Measure 5. And out of that, we have what have happened is about five main issues that we try to address with this bill, or this bill is trying to address, and a few others that would be and are addressed by the Department of Revenue rules. So most urban renewal agency would, in a sense, experience some reduction in the division of tax revenue out of that ruling. Property tax revenue for school districts and community colleges, in other words, all the education segment of the Measure 5 would experience certain type of an increase due to less compression. They are not compressed anymore due to classifying the urban renewal segments as government. So it mainly had to do with the less compression to the school or to the educations. Governments, in the other hand, would experience bigger compression because there's more moved into their categories. Property owners could and do seem to have little relief, less payments. And I tried to put in your packet an example of how the taxes would have been before the urban, excuse me, before the court case and after. A would be how it have shown before the tax court case on the Shiloh Inn of what you're looking at on the same property that has a real market value or in this sense it's a code area, so it's a group of properties with the real market value of $1.25 million and assessed value of $1 million, and chose those numbers for the sake of making it simple and able to look at them. And before the court case, you would have the education and general government and the excluded bonds. These are the three main categories that you're looking at. And looking at those tax rates, and we start with education, you have a permanent rate for schools, ESDs, community colleges, and then local options. And then that would be, as known, what the tax rate in the second column would be the rate of the tax extended. This tax extended would be examined against the Measure 5 limit, and that's the amount where the compression occurs. After the compression, what is left out of that tax ability becomes what the tax imposed would be. And you would see in this example that the compression of 250 came primarily as the part coming to the school or to the general education categories, while the general government with all the different districts did not actually experience any compression. And of course the excluded bonds were all done in a sense that the compression did not occur in those because they are not compressible. They're beyond the limit. And in resultant or the outcome, you would have what value and what percentage and the grand total of your rates, what is taxed imposed. And once we have done all of that, then the division of tax starts working. Then you divide the tax according to when the values were frozen. And in this instance, we've chosen about 50% of the value at the time of freeze and where the tax increment and how it divides and who gets what at that time. After the court ruling, that had a little slight different process. And how it became is during the education segment of the taxes, you start with dividing first. The division becomes the first thing rather than at the bottom end of the process. So the division almost looks like it is a division in the rate itself. And in that sense, your tax extended by the schools becomes the 50% of the amounts of the rates. And then you look at the compression to compare with the Measure 5, and obviously the Measure 5 limit and the compression is so far away from each other that there is no compression in this sense for the schools. So the tax imposed by the education in this sense is the 3,250, which is in the tax imposed in the education section in B. That's what we're looking at, and in essence, that is higher than where A or before the Shiloh N case would have been. The movement goes the other direction when it comes to general government. Seeing the second segment and the general government in the after or the post-Shiloh, after we slice half the rates and extend the tax. And then it applies against the limits of the Measure 5, and you find that there is a higher level of compression in the government that did not occur before. Now, of course, the compression also becomes in order. The first order of compression is for the local options. And in this sense, it's a local option for the county library and also for the school local option that came through government from the education process. So those are first looked at as one big local option and reduced or compressed first before any permanent rate is compressed. We end up with a tax imposed by government that would be lowered in that sense. And the details underneath, it comes to what is for tax and what is for the districts and what is for the tax division or division of tax and how the grand total of the rates. And if you look at the rates in the almost bottom, you find that the rates actually did not change, but the amounts of money that went into a different category and who got what amount of tax at which level have shifted from one place to the other. This is what primarily the Shiloh ruling have resulted in the computational area of the tax division. And House Bill 2187 at least is trying to come and define those in law of saying that all the taxes divided that originate in the school category will be looked at as a government tax because that's the end use of it. And also an important thing that it has or it tries to introduce and resolve that even the bonds that will not be limited by Measure 5 in the previous life, if you will. Now, those that are under division of tax, they also are considered the government expenditure and therefore under the government category, and they would be subject to that limit. And that is the last segment of the bill itself when we're looking at the inclusion of number 7, the new number 7 in the bill. So that's, Mr. Chair, is the lead for this discussion. I'm sure we would have a lot more information during the day with a lot of experienced, knowledgeable witnesses that you have. And
all right, well, let's go to one. John Phillips, why don't you come on up? Thank you, Mason.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. House Bill 2187 is a department bill, and the movie critic, I think, would say, if you like the rule, you'll love the bill. The rule that we passed last May, and I'll talk a little bit about that in my presentation, incorporates some of the components into this bill and basically says that if you don't like the rule, then here's your opportunity to change those policy decisions and put the change in the statute. Mazen did a good job of sort of an overview, and I'll try not to cover some of the same ground, but in December 2001, the Shiloh case opinion was handed down by the Supreme Court, and we knew that coming fall we were going to have to make some quick decisions to help the assessors turn the roll in the fall, given the fact that the court held that statute to be unconstitutional. And the statute in question was ORS 310-150 sub 7, and it said, as Mazen was indicating, that how taxes should be categorized for urban renewal. With that change, changes in programming and changes in tax calculation would have to be accomplished at each county that has urban renewal. And so we acted as a department in our rule writing authority to promulgate a rule that gave direction on how these things should be done. We met twice in February and in August with the interim committee on revenue and briefed the committee on what we were doing and how we were doing it to keep you apprised of what was going on. Some of those decisions contain policy aspects, and that's going out on a limb for us for rulemaking, and we wanted to be sure that you were aware of what we were doing and that you'd have the opportunity this session to put the House in order if you felt like we'd gone too far or misunderstood the direction of the statute. So what I'll say, and I've got two handouts. The first one is just sort of testimony, which I won't go into as much detail on. It's just for your background information. And the second is a copy of our rule. The three things that the bill does is that it requires compression be prioritized for any increment revenues that are derived from local option authority. In the Constitution and in the statute after Measure 50, local options were required to be prioritized. In other words, if a district, let's say a city or a county or a school, had a permanent rate and then another district passed a local option and the local option was competing with the permanent rate, which is sort of the operating base authority for that other district, they didn't want local option authorities to cannibalize other operating taxes of the other taxing districts in the same code area. So that was one priority that was put in the Constitution and in the statute. And so we felt like that theme then should be carried through in the calculation of compression. The second point was requiring any tax revenues derived from both local option and bonds be moved into the general government category. And while this wasn't explicitly stated in the ruling itself, we interpreted the theme of that ruling to say that if the end result, as Mazen pointed out, is to use that money for general government purposes, then the category should be the general government category. And the third thing the bill does is it repeals the statute that was declared unconstitutional. What I'd like to move briefly into was the Shiloh decision itself and just say that I won't belabor that point, but as Mazen indicated, the current law or the way it was done prior to the last session was to categorize these taxes based on the unit of local government that imposed the tax. In other words, if a school imposed the tax, then it fell under the education category and all the way down the line. After the Shiloh decision, as I mentioned, the end result or the end use of the monies determined the categorization, so it was a backward-looking situation. And on the next page, I have just a little example, not the full-blown version, but a very simplified version of what that might look like and how that affects how taxes are calculated in each county. And I just gave you just a quick, really simplified example of frozen value being 150 and excess value being 50 and a total value of 200. Just to give you a three-quarters, one-quarter look at how the value on this particular account or code area might look like. In the pre-Shiloh example, we've got, let's say, a 50-cent rate multiplied by a $200 value for a $100 extended tax, and that's the order in which it occurs. You have a rate, you have a value, you get a tax, you test that tax against the limit, and then the resulting tax that survives the limit test is then divided. That's how it worked. And we didn't need to know which property that needed to occur on at that point because you could perform this calculation on every account and then aggregate it and then do the division. So you could do it at a code area level at which it was done. Post Shiloh, we have to take part of that tax and divide it before the compression because we need to recategorize it. And so in the post Shiloh example, you've got the example of three quarters of a 50-cent rate, because that's the relationship above. And one quarter of a 50-cent rate is moved then down into the general government category. You multiply it times the same total value, and you get the taxes, which are then compressed. And as Mazen's example showed, it can change the result of the compression because you're not competing in the education category like you were before, while you may be competing more in the general government category, so it does some shifting. And the results are there before you, so... That's just my view of a simplified view of how that works and why we had to move the division of tax before the compression calculation, and that's why we had to determine who on which accounts this should occur. On the next page, and of course, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to try and attempt.
That's okay. We can't think of any.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative Barnard.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I did think of one, but it may have answered itself. In your pre-example on the second page of your handout, you don't list the government portion of the tax, and it looks like when you put these numbers against each other that we're actually collecting a larger dollar value of taxes overall in the second example. I suspect that that's not true because there's actually more money collected in the government sample on the first example, the pre-Shiloh example, that you didn't show. But I don't know that. That's why I'm asking the question.
Chair Shetterly, Representative Barnhart, that is just an example, and it would not necessarily be typical. In the pre-Shiloh example, I just listed one rate, and there would most likely be an ESD and a community college in there also, in addition, which would also raise money for the increment. In addition, there would also be the general government category, and each of the rates in the general government category would have the same calculation, and then in the unlimited category also. So it's a very simplified. But the answer to your question is does this second method raise more or less? And that the answer is yes, it can raise more and it can raise less.
Thank you. That's what I thought.
It depends on the unique compression situation on each account. So we have examples in Clackamas County, for example, where some areas there was more raised for urban renewal than previously, pre-Shiloh, and in some areas, in some urban renewal plans, less was raised for urban renewal and more for schools. So it's also hard to say.
John, is that difference, is that really on an account basis or is it on a code area basis? That is, where it might raise more and might raise less?
Chair Shetterly, it would be on an account basis. Because in the post-Shiloh example, our interpretation and the method we suggested to use would require this be done on an account-by-account basis.
Representative Scott.
Thank you very much. I was kind of following you until you said that on a per-account basis, and I could see an area basis, but I don't understand how account basis.
Chair Shetterly, Representative Scott. Measure 5, when it was passed, required compression or the tax limit be applied on an account-by-account basis. In other words, your particular residential property, we'd look at the real market value, we'd apply the $5 and $10 tests, and then we'd compress if it exceeded the limit. When Measure 50 came along, that was removed from the Constitution, the account-by-account basis tests, but it was placed in the statute. So there is the still account-by-account test that occurs. In other words, another way to say that. I guess that's the only way I can think to say it. Am I getting at your question?
You probably are. I just don't understand it.
Since compression is being determined on an account-by-account basis and the effect of this post-Shiloh calculation will be different depending on, as you say, the compression, then that's going to vary on account by account.
Exactly, Chair Shetterly.
Because it's a function of the compression, basically. Is
correct.
That it?
Correct. Representative Scott, some accounts, there is no difference between the real market and the assessed value because of, let's say, depreciation. You have an industrial or personal property account. There is no difference. So the rate times the value, the $5 and the $10 apply directly, whereas there may be more or less room under the cap depending on the difference between the assessed and the real market value.
So does the compression differential property or tax statement by tax statement occur based upon the spread or the differential of the real versus market?
Representative Shetterly, Representative Scott, yes. And there was an Oregonian article several years ago that showed two properties next door to each other. And one was had a larger difference between the assessed and the real market value, and the other one, they were more closely related. And one paid higher taxes because there was more fit under the $5 cap.
This is all part of that horizontal equity issue that
exactly.
Measure 50 got us into. Yeah.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You bet. So then our rule, in the time frame we had, and we didn't do an emergency rule, but we did abbreviate the process a little bit over a 5-month period. And in May, we adopted the rule. We circulated drafts of the rule and requests for input from everybody that we thought was involved in the urban renewal process, and including the attorneys for the Shiloh case. We wanted everybody's input, and we received a good deal of information, and we tried to answer the 5 issues that I've laid out in this next few pages, which I won't go over in detail, 2 of which are incorporated into the bill that's before you today. Another large part of the rule was the incorporation of the changes from last session's House Bill 3215, which I won't go into detail now, but just so that you know, the rule is not wholly made up of changes from the Shiloh decision. So the bill itself on page 6, and I'll just so that you can see by section 1, page 2, line 19, applies to the prioritization of local option taxes. So you know that from Measure 5, taxes are compressed. And they're compressed anytime they exceed the $5 and the $10 limit by category. And to the extent there's a local option tax, or a tax over and above the normal operating authority of the taxing district, then that tax is compared with any other taxes in the category. If the ESD has a local option, if the schools have a local option, if the community colleges have a local option, and the total of all taxes in the education category exceed the $5 limit, then we take those 3 local options and we compress them proportionally first. And if we don't compress them down to the limit, if they still, the operating taxes in the category still exceed the limit, then we turn to the operating taxes from the permanent rates and compress those proportionally, such that a local option passed by one district does not, like I said earlier, cannibalize the operating base revenue for any other taxing district. So that was the theory behind that. So what we're saying is that since every tax rate from any taxing district in which urban renewal exists is divided and raises money for urban renewal, to the extent that that rate is a local option, then that tracking follows through, that prioritization follows through. Second bullet, section 1, page 3, lines 3 through 5, deletes the language that the court found to be unconstitutional. That's the 310.150 sub 7. The next bullet, section 1, page 3, lines 6 through 11. It just states that the money raised through urban renewal special levy or urban renewal division of tax, regardless of where it comes from, is to be categorized under the general government category.
And that's the dictate of the Shiloh case.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's correct. Then page 2, section 2, page 3, makes this bill applicable to the 2002-2003 tax year, and I point that out because that year's already passed. We already did the calculation, and the counties did it according to our rule, to our knowledge, anyway. And this would legitimize that process. And the final section just makes this effective the 91st day. So I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Okay, questions for John.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Barnhart.
Is there anything in here which isn't essentially dictated by the Shiloh case?
Chair Shetterly, Representative Barnhart, I think it could be argued. I personally don't think so, but there are people who would argue that the local option might or might not follow through, the prioritization in the compression might not follow through.
Is that the language on page 2?
That's the language on page 2, yes.
19.
We did receive legal advice from both the Attorney General's office and the Legislative Council's office on this, so we feel pretty strongly about it.
If I follow up, so this case doesn't really address that issue, the Shiloh case. But right. This is the best guess of our lawyers that in the event there was another case, that's what the court would do.
That's my belief, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Berger.
The 3 options that we had, those of us who had urban renewal districts, the local option was the first There were three. Can you refresh my memory on those?
I can try to. Chair Shetterly, Representative Verger, the three options were not... We use the term option quite broadly.
Right.
It applies to a number of circumstances, and this is not one of them. The three options that urban renewal agencies were given in Measure 50 that followed from Measure 50 were to choose impose their increment. One, they could impose less than their full amount. Two, they could impose only a special levy. Or three, they could... there was a third option, which I can't remember off the top
okay.
of my head.
Oh, that's all right. I can't remember it either.
And they are not related to the local option.
Okay. All right.
Those choices were made in 98.
Right.
And I believe we had one that chose option two and several that chose option three. And so...
But that is different than the local option that you're talking about.
That's
here.
Right.
And,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
great.
Yeah. Okay. Other questions for John? I think I'll ask Jeff Tashman to come up next and kind of continue on this overview of the issue and the bill, and then we'll bring up Ms. Simpson. Jeff, and you've got John Russell with you? Do we have a PowerPoint presentation?
We don't have a PowerPoint presentation, but we have a handout.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representatives, my name is Jeff Tashman, and I'm a consultant in the field of urban renewal, and I represent in the legislature the Association of Oregon Redevelopment Agencies, which is an affiliate association of the League of Oregon Cities, and it represents the 47 urban renewal agencies that exist in the state of Oregon. And with me this morning is John Russell. John is the current president of AORA and is a manager of urban renewal programs for the city of Salem. I'm going to go through an overview, and then John is going to talk to you a bit about a project that's of very current interest to the legislature itself that's going on in Salem. To begin with, AORA supports House Bill 2187. We feel it's a fair and an equitable way of implementing the Shiloh decision and House Bill 3215, which we also supported. We also want to really thank and express our appreciation to the Department of Revenue for the manner in which they worked on the administrative rule, which we felt was a very inclusive process, and they devoted a lot of time to bringing all the parties together and in a very systematic way, evaluating what the different alternatives were for implementing Shiloh and involving people in evaluating what the good and bad points of the alternatives were. And so we were very, very pleased to participate in that process. What we would like to do this morning is, with your indulgence, is to just talk a little bit about urban renewal in general, because from my experience working with this committee over the last many sessions, the focus has always been on, well, what's the impact of Measure 5, what's the impact of Measure 50, how can we change this or change that, but there hasn't been a lot of discussion about whether urban renewal is a good thing, and if so, why, and I would like just to take just a minute or two to talk about that. There are 47 communities with urban renewal. There are 68 urban renewal plans, because the community can have more than one urban renewal plan. There's a list of those attached to the handout. There are urban renewal agencies using urban renewal from Brookings to Astoria, from Medford to the Dalles, from Medford to Portland, from Klamath Falls to the Dalles. And in eastern Oregon, we have LeGrand, Milton Freewater. There are three communities that I'm working with now that are in the process of preparing urban renewal plans, and those would be Pendleton, Gresham, and City of Sisters. So it's a very widespread tool. The reason that these communities have adopted urban renewal plans is that it remains the best and maybe the last local tool to promote economic vitality in a community. There's kind of a split in the focus of these plans, but in general they either focus on economic development projects, which are focused on providing infrastructure for industrial uses that create jobs, or they focus on neighborhood revitalization, including downtown, where again, the whole aim of the program is to produce economic vitality and jobs. Now, I wrote this testimony before I picked up the paper this morning, but I referred to the current budget crisis. I just didn't know that it was going to get suddenly worse in the last 24 hours. But it's been clear that people that are in the legislature that are concerned about raising revenues are looking at tax increment financing, and there's a judgment that can be made that, well, gee, tax increment financing diverts property taxes that would otherwise go to schools, and can't that money be used for school financing? What we'd like to say is, first of all, there are really some serious and fairly complicated legal and financial constraints about doing something categorical, like just stopping tax increment financing 100%. If you wanted to look at reducing the scope of it, it's a complicated question, and it's not a simple sort of one-to-one correspondence of taking a dollar away from an urban renewal agency and giving it to a school. It's going to be a lot more complicated than that. But our other point is to look at the benefits that urban renewal provides to any taxing district that's financed by property taxes, including the schools. Now, I think in most cases, most people don't argue that urban renewal does provide a long-term benefit, because if it's a successful program, you're producing assessed value and growth that would not have been there otherwise. And when the tax increment is finished, all of those taxing districts gain access to extra revenue, to additional revenue that would not have been there but for urban renewal. Now, that's a long-term benefit, and it's hard to look at the long-term right now. We also believe that there are some very quantifiable short-term benefits that we haven't focused on before. But, as I said, urban renewal, one of its main focuses is job creation. And in some cases, there are jobs created in urban renewal districts that would not have even been in the state of Oregon but for the urban renewal program. One of the examples I'm going to talk about in a second is from Jackson County in the White City area. There's a plant down there owned and operated by Eastman Kodak, in which they've invested about $140 million. And they were choosing between shutting that plant and they were choosing between that plant and one plant in North Carolina, I believe it was. And they were going to upgrade one and shut the other. And the Urban Renewal Agency in Jackson County was able to provide an incentive for that development that kept that facility in White City, and they, I think the assessed value of the project went from like $60 million to $140, and there are 135 jobs there now that would not have been there but for urban renewal. To the extent that's true, that urban renewal creates jobs that are not going to be in the state otherwise. Another example is the Intel Ron LaRakers project, where they were looking at Austin, Scotland, Ireland, Israel. If those jobs would not be somewhere else in Oregon otherwise, then you're looking at income and income tax revenues in the short term to the state that are being produced by urban renewal. We can't give you any kind of reliable estimate now about what the magnitude of that is, but we are starting to work on that so that we can address that issue of what's the short-term benefit of urban renewal, because we do believe that there is one. In any case, as you consider this bill and maybe other bills that relate to urban renewal, I did want to do a couple of things. I'm going to make available. I have it with me. I'm going to make available to the committee It's a lengthy document. It's a 55-page document that is the history of urban renewal in Oregon. There it is.
Yeah, we have it.
Okay. It was done for PDC and AORA, so it's not a totally objective analysis, but we certainly have included some of the problems as well as some of the successes. And if you don't all have copies, we will get you copies. But just we're also going to be providing some additional case studies in the very near future that are sort of updates. But looking at the examples of what urban renewal can do, I did mention the White City urban renewal area north of Medford in the Rogue Valley. You've had a lot of direct investment that's created jobs, just an absolute one-to-one kind of relationship. And there's also been an enormous amount of investment in infrastructure in the residential part of White City. And White City right now is the only place in the Rogue Valley, really, where a working-class family can afford to buy a new home. You know, it is, by virtue of this not being the most glamorous part of Jackson County to live in, by virtue of flat land, and by virtue of the urban renewal putting in streets, water, and sewer, there are subdivisions going in that working people can afford down there. And you probably know that housing prices down there are otherwise quite high. John's going to be talking about a possible new project for the city of Salem, but Salem already has the Fairview Urban Renewal Area, which was surplus state-owned property generating no tax revenues. It's in a very creative way, it's been converted into the Fairview Industrial Park. And about 1,440 jobs have been created there since the adoption of that plan. In terms of new, what's under consideration now in the city of Tigard, urban renewal is seen as a critical tool for developing the Washington Square Regional Center plan, which is a way of getting a lot more jobs and housing where there's access to transit and commuter rail. And Tigard's also looking at urban renewal as a way of revitalizing its downtown. So to sum up, AORA supports House Bill 2187. We especially appreciate the working relationship that we've had with the Department of Revenue and with Legislative Revenue. And we're ready to engage and assist in a discussion of the long and short-term benefits of urban renewal.
Any questions? John, I guess you were here, I think, when you heard Representative Barnhart's question, I think it was, as to the relationship between the particular elements of House Bill 2187 and the court's decision in the Shiloh Inn case. I guess what would your response be to that?
Besides the parts of it that implement House Bill 3215, John highlighted the judgment call that was made on the characterization of taxes divided from local option levies. And I think when John referred to people being able to argue otherwise on that, I would have to say that myself and several of the attorneys that I work with would be in that class of people that would argue against that particular interpretation. We don't think it flows necessarily or logically from the Shiloh decision. But we have not asked for an amendment on that. We feel that overall the treatment that urban renewal has gotten under this bill has been very fair. And that falls into the realm of a quibble.
Okay. So you're saying you're not satisfied that that's necessarily required as a result of the case, but not to the point of opposing the inclusion of it in the bill.
No, I mean, over coffee, we would be happy to, you know, discuss it, but it's not. You know, we feel, urban renewal feels like it was treated very well in this overall implementation.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Russell.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I am John Russell, current president of AORA. I'm employed by the city of Salem. And I'm going to use that as that's my best experience, but I am appearing as an AORA representative today. I'd like to fill in a couple of additional facts on the Fairview renewal area that Jeff referred to and then talk about another potentially very exciting project that we're working on in Salem. Fairview has produced somewhere in the range of $800 million of investment, of industrial investment, and it's about 3 miles due south of here. That's, as Jeff said, that's over 1,400 jobs in Salem. It's considered the class industrial park in Salem. I think that's fair. It was developed through a partnership of OEDD, DAS, and the City of Salem Urban Renewal Agency. I'd also like to point out that when, in 1998, when we were implementing Measure 5, or Measure 50, excuse me, that Fairview was selected, the option selected in Fairview was option 3, which produced, we returned something in the range of $225 million of assessed value back to the tax rolls because we didn't need the amount of money that it was collecting. It's still open. It's only collecting a total of $460,000 a year, and it's producing very good tax revenues for the City of Salem and the school district. So it's been a great success at a statewide level, I'd have to say. The other project I'd like to talk about is, it's known as the Mill Creek area. It's adjacent to the OSCI on Highway 22. It's approximately 500 acres of state-owned land, declared surplus, adjacent to OSCI, as I said. It would be at the intersection, for those of you familiar with Salem, of Cordon Road and Highway 22, about a mile from I-5 interchange. We are working, we're in discussions between the city and DAS about how to develop that land and turn it into shovel-ready industrial lands for the state. It's already in the City of Salem. It's in the city limits. It would need its own change, but this is probably the best opportunity in the state for a prime industrial park and for new jobs. We are looking at urban renewal as a potential very valuable tool that would assist in that. It could not do it all. It's a very expensive site to develop. It's got wetlands issue. It needs an interchange probably to do it properly with Cordon Road and the state highway, but it is a wonderful example of how we can really provide jobs, which the state desperately needs, as you know better than anyone probably. And we think that renewal may be a great tool to assist in that effort. It's not a done deal. We're still looking at it. The council is discussing. It will come before the legislature this year in one form or another, I'm confident. But I just wanted to bring that to your attention and show you that's yet another way that urban renewal can be very productive.
All right. Yes, Representative Hannes.
What was the property that was sold last year over there?
There's the name escapes me, the police training center is being developed immediately adjacent to this property, but it's all part of a bigger parcel that's been declared surplus. It's DPSS.
DPSST.
Thank you.
Representative Barnhart?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm catching up here, so I'll ask a couple of kind of basic questions, if I may. The Fairview land, that was state-owned property.
Yes, sir.
Correct? And it is now developed and has been sold to private industry and is on the tax rolls.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, the way that was done, it was a negotiated agreement between the Department of Administrative Services and the Urban Renewal Agency. Effectively, there was an option agreement executed between the state and the agency that over time that agreed upon a sales price for that vacant land. Over time, as the agency and the city would recruit an industry, they would then go and buy that land and sell it to the industry at fully developed prices, because the city then put in all of the infrastructure, the sewer, the water, the streets. And so, you know, DAS was accepting a lower price for the land, but it was bare farmland. And so from a combination of the urban renewal revenues, from proceeds from the land sales, and from loans and grants from OECD, that property was developed into a prime industrial park.
Yeah. If I may. Is it fully built out?
There is two remaining parcels.
And last question on this topic. How many acres are we talking about altogether?
Representative Barnhart, Chair, about 300.
300 acres.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Berger.
Yeah, I have to comment for the information of others in the committee. John mentioned the Mill Creek. I met yesterday with the mayor of Salem and the governor on this. We're we're moving forward to try and make this, it's prime land for the shovel-ready model, and I think you'll hear more about it.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did you have another question?
One question. I'm sorry.
Don't move.
What's the size? You indicated there's 500 acres in the Mill Creek area. What was the size of the total area in that we're talking about that included the police training center and whatever else there might be out there that could end up in private ownership as a result of this sort of redevelopment?
I don't know that answer, Representative.
Is it significantly larger than 500 acres or not?
I think the DPSST may have been in the 100-acre range. I'm not intimately familiar with that.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
Yeah.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Oh, yes. Representative Park.
A little tongue-in-cheek here. I see Salem already has four URDs and looking at one more. In Eugene, we have two, and both of those are dreadfully under fire all the time. I wonder if you could help us transplant a little bit of the attitude from Salem to Eugene.
Representative, I would decline that. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Committee, as you may have noted, I actually encouraged some testimony that went beyond just the scope of the bill because I thought it was important for us to have some context since we don't deal with urban renewal very much and most of us are not conversant in it. So I encouraged the witnesses to give us more than just testimony specific to the particulars of the bill because the bill itself is very narrow, but again, I think it would help us understand the bill if we have a fuller understanding of urban renewal in the big picture. So to give us the other side of the, let me say an alternative view, I guess, but giving her the same latitude, let's bring up Pat Simpson. Those of you who haven't been here before, Pat, you come up from Bandon, what, probably four or five times a session, do you? Is it that often?
Not quite.
Not quite, okay. No. Just whenever urban renewal is on the agenda.
That's right.
Yeah, right.
It's hard enough just to follow one item. I don't know how representatives and senators follow all the items that you're voting on. I truly don't understand. You know, because as you know, just urban renewal itself is very complex, unfortunately getting more complex. And at the tail end of what I was going to say, I think it's become a house of cards.
Well, Pat, if you could introduce yourself for the record and then give us your testimony. Again, I would give you the same latitude as I've given other witnesses to talk generally about urban renewal, but then kind of wrap up to the bill as well.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you very much, Chair Shetterly and all the representatives on the committee. I'm just a private citizen, no special training, just hard perseverance. When we came to Oregon, where we came from had an urban renewal area that somebody was involved with, and we were busy fighting pollution, so I didn't get a chance to learn anything about urban renewal. Well, not too long after that, we moved to Oregon, and my husband doesn't have asthma for the first time in our 50 years of marriage, and he had it since he was 6 years old. So we've been here 7 years, and he's been asthma-free, and so we haven't dug into air pollution around here, obviously, then. And so I said, well, gee, Bandon has two urban renewal areas. Let's find out about urban renewal. So anyhow, that's how it all started and then came here. So and I appreciate very much having been put on an interim work group several years ago, and I especially appreciate Chairman Shetterly's help in getting House Bill 3215 passed, which helped to cure some of the faults I feel that reside in urban renewal, and that was that new bonds and new local options don't have to have this division of taxes with urban renewal. So that's only for the new ones, and of course that makes an easier transition because you can't too well say, you know, take all the, which is what I had originally proposed, just all of a sudden not have to have any of the bonds or any of the local options have to be shared with urban renewal because they may have long-term commitments for urban renewal bonds, and this would shake up their finances too much. So anyhow, I think that was a good compromise and a good direction trying to help reform urban renewal. Much of the meetings that we had that winter after that work group was formed had to do with basically there are only two of us opposing about 20 people for urban renewal. Of course, all these people earned their living by urban renewal. And the other two people were just private citizens who, for one reason or another, had become involved in urban renewal. And we kept bringing up, you know, things that needed remedied. And these people kept saying, no, one of us objects. And so, therefore, that whole subject was killed. So I was extremely pleased to at least to salvage that we had one bill and one type of reform. I feel I think it was a good learning process for all of us also, because even some of those experts who earn their living by working with related to urban renewal learned a little bit. I'm sure us two citizens also learned something. So it was not a total exercise in futility. One of the things that had come to my attention over the period of time was there was, I believe the name of the town was Canby, and there's a fire taxing district who was really, are you related to that Canby?
I live there.
Oh, okay, very good. What I think their position is that there was an industrial park which is going to be developed, so this is going to be a big increment for taxation purposes, which everybody says, oh, this is wonderful, you know, all the taxing districts get more money, et cetera. However, the fire department pointed out that this is a great big additional increase in their responsibilities to have a big industrial park all of a sudden, and they wouldn't be getting practically 1 cent more support for extra equipment, manpower, whatever, that they would need for their additional responsibilities. And why not? Because all the taxes paid on the increased value, of course, would go fed back into the urban renewal area to take care of their development needs and so on. And so long as that stayed an urban renewal area and abandoned, we have our urban renewal areas now are over 15 years old. And there's no sign that they're ever going to get rid of it, because the cities, frankly, really enjoy having urban renewal, because they get a chance to get money, taxes from outside their own taxing district. They get money. And Bandon, I figured out a couple years ago, and I was going to try to figure it out today, and I just gave up. But anyway, what I found a couple years ago was that Bandon gets over half of its amount of money from properties outside of the city limits. And at that time, they were getting special levy. And as you know, the special levy is a tax only for the people inside the city limits. So given that they had special levy and division of tax, over half that amount of money came from outside of the city limits. And I think that's important with regards to House Bill 2187, which I'll bring out later. Anyhow, back to Canby. I think you should all take that in consideration. You hear all about these wonderful developments where every renewal, everybody's taxes pinched off from all the different taxing districts, is going to put in infrastructure, we're going to put in big new developments and so on. Hey, if that big new development is no longer an urban renewal area in, say, 5 years, something reasonable, okay, then I might agree that urban renewal might be a good use of the money. But if it goes on for 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, then I say it's not a good use of the money, because look at Canby, you know, the good old fire department there, it's put out all those fires and it never got a new fire truck from the increased taxes, because it never got any of the increased taxes. That is the big flaw with urban renewal. And, of course, people like Jeff Pashman, who's a much better speaker than I am, won't bring out the flaws. But really, you folks, I feel so badly, you know, that I live so far away and he's so close and so good. And he tells you guys all these other things. So please try to understand what I'm trying to say rather than how well I've done it or something like that.
Representative Scott has a question or comment?
Well, the only comment that I would make on behalf of the Canby one, I think it's fair to say that although your statements are partially true, there have been agreements that the city of Canby and the fire Good. Department have reached that allows the urban renewal funds to be utilized in fashions that may not buy a fire truck, but do help offset other costs that the fire department has that puts it within the scope of the urban renewal district to allow the fire department to have some comfort. I won't say entire comfort, but some comfort within the and I think that may be somewhat debatable with representation from them, but I think that that's fair to say that it may not buy a specific fire truck, but there are other means of which have been negotiated that will benefit the fire department directly.
Great. But that wasn't built into urban renewal, and if they hadn't protested, they wouldn't have gotten it.
Actually, I believe it was. It wasn't understood, but it was.
It's not built into the urban renewal laws.
No, that's correct.
So it's very good that they worked this out, because I think something like that is a real noticeable problem. I'm glad to hear that it's been improved. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Okay. Urban renewal is supposed to, by law, cure blight. Now it's become a job creation tool. We have an awful lot of economic development creation tools. I'm a little bit surprised to hear that now that's the emphasis. But anyhow, back to the original thing. I gave you a handout. That's probably a good, relatively good summary, not quite complete of what I'd like to say now, but I'd like to deviate from that. That would be just sort of like a reference material. So going in a different direction, covering more or less the same material. What is it that Hospital 2187 is trying to accomplish? Well, as they all said, it's the Shiloh indecision, which, of course, is basically breaking out the urban renewal that's hidden in the taxes. What we normally would have looked at our tax bill and said urban renewal, and we would have said the school's getting this much money, the city's getting this much money, and so on. And the same thing with the bonds. And so what we're going to do now is to turn about and say we're going to break out and show on the tax bill that we're taking out the part that actually goes to urban renewal, because that now should be shown in the government section. And this has, this is really what should have been done, of course, right along, I think. I think Shiloh Lynn forcing us to look at this is a great opportunity to do it right. Because we did something like this before Measure 50 came along. There was a line item, and it said, hey, guys, this is what you're paying to urban renewal. But it was wrong. And like the county assessors had said, it was wrong. Yeah, we know it was wrong. But at least it was a direction. It was in the right direction. Because otherwise, before that, they said people thought urban renewal was totally free. And the way it was wrong is more or less the way it's now going to be wrong again. And I really hate to see it become wrong twice within my short lifetime in Oregon. You know, this is the time, this is the opportunity to get it right for the very first time in Oregon to show what urban renewal costs. And also to show how much money, what rate, how much money is actually going to the individual taxing districts. In other words, after they've had to divide with urban renewal. So now you're going to have a really truth in billing for the very first time. Since 1960, I think, urban renewal was implemented. By the way, Jeff, can I have a copy of your history?
Yeah, I think there are copies available over on the table now.
Oh, wonderful. Of his 50-page history?
I think so. Did we bring you some extras?
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you. Yeah. That's wonderful. Because I've been trying to follow some of that. So anyhow, they got it wrong. How did they get it wrong before when at least, as the assessor said, at least you're pointing in the right direction? They got it wrong because they assumed that all the money that was given to urban renewal, let's say you're just talking about city urban renewals, because then you can always extrapolate to counties. It's hard enough to think about just the city urban renewal, frankly. You can't think of both at the same time. It's too hard. Anyhow, for city urban renewal, they assumed that all the money that was generated for urban renewal in that city came from the properties in that city. And like I said, from what I figured out from Bandon's case a couple of years ago, over half that money really came from the properties outside the city limits. And you could look at it easily and say, okay, like school district in a small town like Bandon, you have a school district which is larger than the city and it overlaps the city totally. And so that whole taxing district has to give, in our case, 5% of its money to urban renewal for this division of taxes. Well, that money is coming from the properties in the city and the properties outside the city, I'd say equally. Now, of course, the court decision didn't say. It said, do this. It didn't say from whom you're going to pluck this stuff and give it to urban renewal, you know, in the government section, right? So you could pick. You could decide. Take your 10 biggest taxpayers in the city and say, okay, we have to get so much money, and we have to show it in the government section for compression to fulfill the law. And so all we have to do is, you know, pluck it off of these 10 that we happen to like. You know, I mean, they're nice guys, or we want to encourage them to stay here. This is an economic incentive or whatever reason. And we could, you know, put it into their government section. They could have a lulu of a compression because they're not going to have to hardly pay anything, you know, compress down to nothing. It would be a gift to them, a real gift, you know. Or you could say, oh, let's assume it's all the properties in the city only that have the urban renewal. And let's take those individual properties instead of the 10 guys and let's do the same thing. Or let's look at it like in the case, like I said, the school district. Everybody in the school district is contributing. And for their bonds for the school district in our town, they have to pay 5% more for their old bonds And the city of Bandon, by the way, has 40-year bonds, so it's going to take a while for that 3215 to be really fully implemented, of course. So anyhow, they have to pay, they have to charge 5% more. So the people outside the city are paying 5% more on the school bonds because of Bandon's urban renewal. And the people outside the city say, I don't care what Bandon does with their urban renewal, I'm outside the city limits. I says, oh yeah, you like to pay 5% more on your school bonds, et cetera, because there's also county bonds and so on, you know. I always didn't talk with my hands too much, sorry. So anyhow, then they get a little bit interested. So here we have, to implement Shiloh, we have the opportunity of showing on their tax statement that, hey, they are paying, in fact, into urban renewal when they thought they weren't. So, you know, that's when you're breaking out what they're actually contributing. And these statistics are known because the tax, the assessor's office knows that the Bandon School District has 5% has to go to urban renewal in Bandon. It knows that the city taxes have 10% have to go to urban renewal in Bandon, et cetera. Because they have to know this, you know, to break the money apart and give it the money to urban renewal the old-fashioned way, the way they used to, right? So these figures are known. So I'm saying, hey, you know, use them, get it right, remedy the problem that they had before Measure 50, you know, essentially do what they were doing in Measure 50 by putting a statement in the government section to be addressed properly by compression, but do it right. So another thing is, though, this is really a policy change. And I say, does the question is, does Hospital 2187 address the Shilohian implementation? And I'd say no. Superficially, it does, because it says, hey, guys, you know, we're going to put this stuff over here into the government section. But it doesn't say, basically, who pays? That's their first question. Department of Revenue is first out of the five questions, which we've got a chance to skim through real quick right now. That is sort of like the key question, who pays? I'm trying to make the case, in the case of the taxes for the bonds and in the case of the school, and the fixed levy amounts even, fixed rates, what are they called?
Permanent rates,
thank you. that it's the whole district that's really affected. And if the whole district feels they don't have enough money, they might go for local option tax, right? And the local option tax would affect the whole district, not just the people in the city. So, and like I said, in the Bandon case, and I think in most other cases, they get a great deal of their money from the taxing districts who are dividing, because most of the taxing districts overlapping these things include outside the city, except for maybe if you get to Portland, it might be a totally different thing. Because you have such a big city, you know, it might, what I'm saying might not hold. But you have a lot of canbies and whatever that I think the, you know, the county district and school districts might be larger than the city. So anyhow, one would have to actually, you know, look and see. But from my limited experience, anyhow, they get a great deal of their money from outside the city. So you can't ignore that. You can't. It's really wrong to say we're only going to extract this and let the people in the city assume that they're getting all their money from just inside the city, and now we're going to proportion it out, and we're going to make it be available to them for compression. Because first of all, you're giving away goodies when you give away extra stuff going into that compression level, because those who, you know, get this moved out from the two sections to the government section for compression, that's an advantage, generally speaking. So you're saying the people outside the city contribute to the urban renewal inside the city, but they don't get a chance to do this compression, and it doesn't show in their tax bill. So I think that's wrong. So does it matter where you pinch off this money from and put it? And I said I think it does for the letter of the law, or the intent, rather, not the letter of the law, because it wasn't very explicit for the Shilohian decision. The intent was to take out the money which is truly going to urban renewal and put it into the government section and then move into compression. And if you don't consider all the properties in the whole taxing district, then you're giving extra benefits to, like I said before, to the actually to the properties in the city that have the urban renewal. Hey, they're already presumably benefiting from this extra money being applied to their pet projects and so on, so why should they also benefit from the extra compression? So it's just totally not fair. So Currently, the urban renewal is very hard to understand. It's very hard to implement, and it's getting extremely hard to modify in the future. And I mentioned, I think it's a house of cards. I think it ought to be phased out. And I think it ought to be phased out in a financially very responsible way so that the current urban renewals are not going to be impacted at all by phasing out urban renewal. What I would like to suggest is that one would say, okay, no new urban renewals under this really complex plan that we have can be created. And we want to make sure that the old ones that are existing are not dishonored. They're no trouble with meeting their debt obligations at all. So what I would see is something like perhaps saying current urban renewal areas are not allowed to have any more new debt. And it's already in the ORS, Chapter 457 for urban renewal. It says when you've finished out your debt, you no longer have debt, you must go away. What would be simpler? No problem. Okay, but we say, but we still want to have something like urban renewal. Let's go ahead and, you know, throw out the old, which is so cumbersome, and like a house of cards example, and so tedious and so time-consuming. County assessor's office, everybody, you folks, everybody. Replace the current urban renewal concept with a new, improved local urban renewal. And just like you all made the special levy pertain only to the local, to the area that wanted it. So if a city wanted the special levy, it's the city then that is doing the taxing. Okay, so be very simple. No lawyers are needed, no urban renewal lawyers. So get rid of a few jobs in the state, and that's not what you want to do, right? But it's not clear you want to create lawyer jobs anyhow. Mm-hmm. Now that Chair Shetterly is gone, I can say that because I believe he's a lawyer. But anyhow, all joking aside, the part of the law would be for the new local urban renewal is that they would not have to divide their money with urban renewal. Like, you know, local option taxes and so on have to divide their money with the urban renewal. So we'd have them say that would be a bonus to them. They could keep more of their money because they're, you know, that's the old urban renewal because they're replacing it. Okay, so they get to keep all their money they collect. It would be voted in by the people who would be paying the tax. So it would be voted on, let's say, in the city case, by the city, and they are the ones who would be taxing themselves. Then they would also vote for a specific fixed rate, a specific number of years, and a specific project. And when that is done, then it would go away. If they wanted another one for another project over here, then they'd have another one. So, and the project could be in any location. This is a bonus because right now Bannon's got the problem. They got this urban renewal money, but it can only be funneled to projects in our two urban renewal areas. And that's a limitation because sometimes you want to go over here further. And also with urban renewal, the way it's written now and the increased value, the taxes, you have to have that urban renewal area sitting around for at least 5 years before you start really getting any money out of it with the increase in the increment and the taxes on the increased value. This would have instant gratification at starting off at a fixed return because you had a fixed rate. So you know what you're getting. So you could take out a bond or just pay as you go, whatever it is on the project you want. So you'd have local control, local responsibility, and everybody would be able to understand it. You could explain this to a third grader instead of what we have now with urban renewal. So I've run out, and I think I appreciate very much the opportunity to say something. And I appreciated the opportunity a couple of years ago to be on the interim work group for urban renewal. And in that length of time in between, you know, the distance between Bannon and Salem has gotten longer. But I was glad I made it. So thank you very much. Oh, any
thank
questions?
Thank you, Pat, very okay. much for being here.
Thank you.
Mrs. Simpson is in my county.
Yes.
Not in my district.
Right, as you pointed out in our first email.
and I welcome her here very much. There are a couple of things that I would like to ask you. One, you mentioned being out of debt, but that's in the ORS now.
That's what I said. It's already in the ORS.
Out of debt, they go away. So
that's they're supposed to.
Are you? How? I mean, that's there. Are you
right.
saying that there are urban renewals that go out of debt and don't go away?
Yes, Bandon's.
Bandon's went out of debt.
Oh, yes, it sure did. We tried to get our special levy away from urban renewal with a tax swap, because we were given a committee was set up and how to fix our streets, preferably without increasing taxes. So we worked on it and thought about it, and we kept saying, gee, we got so much money from urban renewal, and it all has to go just to these two areas, and the rest of the town is blighted. You know, the rest of the town had these awful dirt streets, gravel streets, and very dusty and very potholy. And so we kept thinking about it, and finally I woke up one morning and I said, the special levy is optional. The city manager wants it. He wants more money. But the city manager also wanted to have the streets paved. So we tried to tell him, look, and he was about ready to take out a huge bond, because, see, we were out of debt, and he wasn't going to emphasize that, right? So, and then that would commit to the special levy. There's no way we could say, let's stop the special levy and start a local option tax for streets. And he was pursued. We said even, pay attention to us. We're working on this problem. Don't do what you seem to be talking about, getting this bond. And he just was going in that direction. And so I resigned from the committee, standing up there and saying, you know, you're not paying attention to us. And he's charging off, and we're running out of time. And so we went to a lawyer, and we put all of our little thoughts together, including they're out of debt. He hadn't disbanded the urban renewal area. One of them was out of debt, at least. Maybe the other one wasn't. Anyhow, so we found some other little piddly things that were not quite legal. And when you get a lawyer, put them down, you know, like three or four piddly things, they pay attention. Anyhow, so we got him all of a sudden. It took only a couple hours, and he was on our side 100%, and now the streets are paid, and we have a 10-year local option tax. We're really pleased with it. So that's why I'm saying, and see, we could use it all outside the urban renewal areas. And the rest of the town was blighted. Now it's not super, but it's much, much better. So anyhow, that's why I think this other type of thing would work. And we convinced the voters, without very much money being spent on campaigning either, let's vote for a tax swap. The city manager says he won't ask for the special levy. You know, we'll use the same raise what was calculated the last time, and that'll be our fixed rate for this local option for 10 years, and so we did it.
Well, certainly so, change Bandon. The streets look great.
Yeah.
They have lots of strip paving. I kind of like curbs and gutters, but
I do too.
Strip paving improved it.
We didn't get the Cadillac version. We'd love to have gotten a Cadillac version, but it would have been so much more expensive. We wouldn't have been able to, within the 10 years, do that. And because the city manager also put in that we're going to do some maintenance on other streets. So, I mean, you have to keep up with that. So that's part of the 10 years for the tax swap. And so that's why we don't have sidewalks. He's going to work on some sidewalks somewhere else, though, you know, another means. So we'll hopefully get a little bit more civilized.
Right.
It's a nice little town, but it's not too civilized.
Right. Are there other questions for
Madam Chair, this is not a question, this is a comment. Ms. Simpson, I'm very admiring, from air pollution to urban renewal, you like to take on the really big, complicated issues. I have served on an urban renewal advisory board, and it is about as complicated a scheme, and I'm very admiring that you would...
And it shouldn't have to be.
Well, I understand your points, but I'm just...
All right.
I'm just
trying to give me a compliment. Thank you.
I'm just telling you that I admire you taking this on, whether I agree with you on this specific issue or not, this bill.
Right, yeah. Right. Well, if you do this bill, I'm not saying that this bill shouldn't be done. I'm saying it should, I'd say it should be modified. Maybe I didn't make that part very well. It should be modified. First of all, I think I skipped that part totally.
To the bill.
To the bill, right.
Yeah.
The policy decision is not being made in this bill as to who pays. And I think that the legislature should make this policy decision, not leave it to the administrative people to make this decision. And I think that the policy decision should show up in the ORS. And back before Measure 50, it was in the ORS, as to how we're going to assume that it's only the city that pays for it and how we actually are going to apportion it out. So the people who are reading about urban renewal in the ORS shouldn't have to go to the ARA. ELFS. O-A-R, the administrative rules.
Mm-hmm.
To find out that, gee, in fact, we're saying, oh, they're assuming that the city is the only one who's paying it. You know, if you go with that, please... Whatever way you decide to try to apportion this money out, please put it into the ORS. There's a whole chapter in urban renewal. When people are trying to read about urban renewal, it should be clear in there as to how we're treating this particular, how we're going to take this and put the urban renewal into the government section.
So, Pat, if I understand your testimony, it's not so much that you're opposed to House Bill 2187, but that you think that this is an invitation to make some of the policy changes that that you're advocating, and that it should go further than it does. Is that basically it?
I say that the policy decision should be made by you folks, not by administrative,
right.
And it should be in the ORS.
Yeah, but I'm saying
whether even if you implement what the DOR implemented for last November, mm-hmm. that should be in the ORS. Okay, but what I'm saying is I would really feel much more comfortable if you remedied the problem of what we had before Measure 50 and did it right so that you could look at your tax bill and see how much money is going to this education, how much is going to this hospital, how much is going to the library, et cetera. And if you do it on a whole taxing district-wise, you could do that. And then, by the same token, I could look to see how much money is going to urban renewal. And right now, my tax bill is useless so far as showing that because Bandon gets so much of its money, over half from outside of the city. But it looks like we, the properties in the city, are paying, giving all this money to urban renewal. So I see this whopping big urban renewal statement. My neighbor down the street who's outside the city limits says she's not paying anything at all to the urban renewal, which she is. Okay, so it lies. It is incorrect. So this is the opportunity to do it right for the very first time.
Representative Farr.
Thank you. Just a general note on urban renewal. I spent 8 years on the Eugene Agency Board, and I'd like to invite you to see downtown Eugene. It is indeed a complex issue. However, the bottom line is it can work, and it can work very admirably. If you've not been to Eugene in the last 6 months, I invite you to go down there and see what urban renewal really can do. Check out the new library, check out the new transit station, check out the newly opened streets and the revitalized retail in downtown. It can work.
Representative Berger.
Chair Kennedy, I'd just like to comment. Mrs. Simpson can't see. Behind her, or probably hasn't noticed, but the room is now full of students, school students. And I want to just point out to you that Mrs. Simpson has certain issues that she's been very involved in her area of the state of Oregon. And she spends lots of time in watching those issues and in participating as a citizen in those. And I would challenge those of you who are students and visiting with us today that those issues that you're interested in, you have an opportunity to participate in right now, even if you're age. So you don't have to wait until you're in the legislature as we are, or as you are an adult, as Mrs. Simpson is, to participate in Oregon politics and in policy making. So,
thank you. And right now, anybody want to come up and talk to us about urban renewal? Anything else, Pat?
I appreciate very much your time and Representative Verger making that statement because we need the young people to be aware of our government, and I think the Oregon Constitution has the most wonderful, very beginning part of the Oregon Constitution, which says, this is our government, okay? It belongs to the people. The power is in the people, it says. Read the very, very, very first part of the Oregon Constitution. It says the power is in the people, and we have the right to change it in any fashion, in any way that we want. Okay, and this is wonderful. We don't have to be begging our city governments, et cetera, for our little rights to speak or our little something or others because it is our government. But if you folks don't take that upon yourself as a right and a privilege and exercise it to the best of your ability, you have to do your research first, you know, before you come up and try to talk to these guys. But anyhow, we're going to lose a lot of freedom that's actually in the Constitution. So thank you for being here.
Well,
and thank you for the opportunity.
Well put, Pat. Thank you. Okay, thanks for coming up.
Thank you.
Does anybody else wish to testify on House Bill 2187 here today? I'm seeing no one rushing to the desk, then my inclination is to close the public hearing on House Bill 2187. We do not have this set for work session today. We will bring this back and we'll talk with the staff about rescheduling House Bill 2187 for work session. We won't go there today. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2187 And committee, we have two LCs in front of us. LC 2197 is a committee bill relating to system development charges, IC. House Bill 3295 is a committee bill relating to taxation. Both of these are presented as committee bills. They are not being, at least the requesters are not identified for the record, so we will not be indicating that on the bill introduction. Chair would move introduction of LC 2197 and LC 3295 as committee bills, again with the caveat that your support of this does not indicate any kind of support for the bill or that the bills would even necessarily receive a hearing, but they are going into the process as an accommodation. Is there any objection to the introduction of LC 2197 and LC 3295 as committee bills? Hearing none, those LCs are introduced as committee bills. And with that, colleagues, we are adjourned for the morning, and hopefully you visitors enjoy the rest of your day here at the Capitol.
Thank you.